Welcome to The World Shapers, conversations with science fiction and fantasy authors about the creative process. I'm your host, Edward Welland, and this episode's guest, Walter John Williams. Welcome to another episode of The World Shapers, the podcast where I talk to other science fiction and fantasy authors about the creative process. My name is Edward Willett. I'm your host, and I am myself an author of science fiction and fantasy. My most recent book from a major publisher is The Moonlit World, which came out from Daw Books in September, and the paperback will be out, mass market paperback will be out in August. It's book three in my World Shaper series, and I hope to be writing book four soon. Although that won't be published by Daw, but I still plan to write it. And I've also got a couple of books from my own publishing company, Shadow Paw Press, are pretty new. There's an epic YA fantasy novel called Blue Fire, which I wrote under my pseudonym E.C. Blake, or attached my pseudonym to it anyway. There's a space opera duology, Peregrine Rising, Right to Know, and Falcon's Egg, which are out now. And something that's kind of fun, you might want to check out, is a time-traveling version of myself from 1984, when I was in my 20s, popped forward and published Assignment Avalon. This was a science fiction adventure I wrote back then when I was better known as Eddie Willett. So I've published it as Eddie Willett. I've given it a bit of a spit and polish, but it's not too different from what I originally wrote back in 1984. And it's on Amazon exclusively at the moment as an ebook if you want to check that out, Assignment Avalon. However, my main thing that's going on right now is I am kickstarting an anthology. This will be the second time I've done this. Last year, I successfully kickstarted Shapers of Worlds, which you might guess from the title is related to this podcast. And indeed, it was short fiction and science fiction and fantasy from guests from the first year of the podcast. There were 18 stories in all, 9 original stories, 9 reprints. It was very successfully kickstarted. And all the time I was doing that, I thought, you know, if this works, I should do it again. And sure enough, here we are. The Kickstarter for Shapers of Worlds Volume 2 is now live, and it's going to be bigger than last year's anthology because more authors have agreed to take part. So if this one funds, it is going to feature original fiction from Kelly Armstrong, Marie Brennan, Helen Dale, Candace Jane Dorsey, Lisa Foyles, Susan Forrest, James Allen Gardner, Matthew Hughes, Helly Kennedy, Lisa Kessler, Adria Laycraft, Ira Naiman, Garth Nix, Tim Pratt, Edward Savio, Brian Thomas Schmidt, Jeremy Zoll, and me, plus reprints from Jeffrey A. Carver, Barbara Hambly, Nancy Kress, David D. Levine, S. M. Sterling, and Carrie Vaughn. So that's going to be a very exciting anthology to bring to life if I can get it funded. I'm about not even a week in, and it's at 43% as of today. So looking promising, but it is kind of in that middle part of the Kickstarter when things move very slowly. So this would be a great time to get in and back it. You can find it at tinyurl.com/shapersofworlds2, Arabic numeral 2. Check that out. You can get all the details there. You can see some videos from some of the authors. And, of course, all the great backers' rewards. There's something like 100 or more autographed books available as backers' rewards, plus ebooks. There are signed book plates. There are audio books. And I'm even offering short story critiques and one-on-one consultations. And if you really want to shell out, for $3,000, I am offering a 3-month mentorship, which would be hours and hours of work on a project of your choice. So check that out, and I hope that you will kick in and help make it happen. It should be out, assuming it funds. The commercial release of the book would be in the fall. I can't pin it down more than that, obviously, but certainly before Christmas would be the goal to have the commercial version of the book out. And if it funds, then there'll probably be a third volume, volume 3 of Shapers of Worlds, which would then feature my third year guests, including today's guest, Walter John Williams, which we're about to get to. But I do want to mention that this podcast is part of the Saskatchewan Podcast Network. Okay, let's get to this week's guest, who is indeed Walter John Williams. Walter John Williams is the Nebula Award-winning New York Times bestselling author of more than 40 volumes of fiction, in addition to works in film, television, comics, and gaming. He began his career writing historical fiction, the sea adventure series Privateers and Gentlemen, then when the market for historical novels died, began a new career as a science fiction writer. Since then, he's written cyberpunk, near-future thrillers, classic space opera, new space opera, post-cyberpunk, epic fantasy new weird, and the world's only gothic western science fiction police procedural, Days of Atonement. He's also a reasonably prolific writer of short fiction, including contributions to George R. R. Martin's Wild Cards project. Williams has been nominated for numerous literary awards and won Nebula Awards in 2005 and 2011. In addition to fiction, he's written a number of films for Hollywood, although none of them have yet been made. He's also maintained a foot in the gaming industry, having written RPGs based on his Privateers and Gentlemen series and his novel Hardwired, contributed to the alternate reality game Last Call Poker, and written the dialogue for the Electronic Arts game Spore. In 2017, he was the guest of honor at the 75th World Science Fiction Convention held in Helsinki. In addition to writing, Williams is a world traveler, scuba diver, and a black belt in Kenpo karate. He lives in New Mexico. So, Walter, welcome to the World Shapers.
Happy to be here.
I always try to find connections, and I can think of two. You live in New Mexico, and I was born in New Mexico, so that's something.
Okay.
I was born in Silver City, New Mexico.
Silver City.
Didn't live there very long. We moved to Texas, and then we moved from Texas to Canada, which is where I am now. But yeah, so there's that connection.
Yeah, and he's quite pretty and has quite a history. So
I don't believe I've ever seen it when I was old enough to remember it. I know we went back a couple of times when I was young, but I don't have any memories of it, unfortunately.
Well, the thing I like about certain old towns is, you know, if they were, say, a mining town, silver mining town, which Silver City was, and then the silver mining went bust, they never had enough money to tear down their old Victorian town and build up an ugly new modern one. Mm-hmm. So it's still got all these beautiful Victorian buildings and stuff, as does all the surrounding area.
It's a bit like Moose Jaw here in Saskatchewan. They had a couple of fires in the early years that burned everything down. So they passed a bylaw that everything had to be built out of brick.
Ah, okay.
And then there was kind of a boom and then a bust, and a lot of those old brick buildings are still there. So Moose Jaw has some really nice character buildings still existing. Mm-hmm. Plus it has that name, Moose Jaw, going for it. So there's that. The other connection is we did actually eat at the same restaurant at some convention, but I can't remember which one. It was probably Denver or Reno, but I can't pin it down beyond
that. I'll have to take your word for it. I've eaten in many restaurants at many conventions.
Yeah, so have I at this point. You more than me, I'm sure. And they do tend to kind of run together over time. Mm-hmm. Well, anyway, so that's not actually what we're going to talk about. We're going to talk about your writing process. But first, I want to take you back into the mists of time, which is getting further and further back for some of us, I guess for all of us, really. Where did you grow up, and how did you get interested in reading and writing and all that good stuff? How did you get started in this strange way of making a living?
I was born and raised in Duluth, Minnesota, and I always wanted to be a writer. As soon as I knew what a writer was, I wanted to be that. And I was probably 4 years old. I didn't know how to read or write yet, so I would dictate stories to my parents, who would write them down for me. And then I would illustrate them with my crayons, and fortunately, none of those have survived. it wasn't a choice for me. I was compelled to be a writer, and I just worked hard at it all my life until I managed to sell some fiction, and then I worked hard at writing more fiction to sell. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, if you wanted to be a writer, that must have come from having encountered books. So was there a reading component to your wanting to become a writer, I presume?
Once again, I didn't know how to read, but I had books read to me and comic books, which I think were a big influence on my very early writing development. Since I was better with crayons than I was with, you know, actually crafting prose. So, let's see. And so my family left Duluth and moved to New Mexico when I was 13. And with some exceptions, I've been here ever since.
Did you study writing formally at some point, or was it?
I took some creative writing classes in college. I'm not sure that they helped. I think, you know, I took a lot of literature courses, and that exposed me to a lot of different material, different writers, different ways of writing, different approaches to writing. And those were turned out to be quite valuable. But the actual writing classes, probably they did no harm.
Well, I often ask writers about that, and more often than not, I've rarely gotten a ringing endorsement of creative writing courses at the university level from anybody I've talked to on the podcast. So that's interesting. Were there specific books, once you were reading your own books, were there specific books along the way that influenced you, do you think?
And writers? Science fiction was an early passion. I think I was in second grade when my mom, who was not a science fiction person at all, sort of marched through the local public library one day, and she knew I would like science fiction, so she grabbed a couple science fiction books off the shelf and brought them home for me. And the first one was Robert Heinlein's Half Space It Will Travel, which is still my favorite Heinlein novel.
Mine too, actually.
Yeah. I don't know why it hasn't been made into a movie. It would be glorious. So I read science fiction all from second grade on. I was really fond of books about natural history and animals, including, you know, fiction about animals, you know, The Jungle Book and so on. And then I just continued. I read a ton of history because I just loved history. And that's a big influence on one of my current projects.
Just mentioning animal books, did you read the Black Stallion books by any chance?
No, I did not. They were not available.
The only reason I ask is I often ask if anybody has encountered them, because it's perhaps little known that Walter Farley wrote a subsection of those, the Island Stallion books, that were actually science fiction. There's like aliens involved along with horse racing. And
if I'd known that, I would have sought them out, I'm sure.
His final book that he wrote late in life, Alec and the Black Are Wandering Around the Southwestern Desert, Arizona, I think, not New Mexico. Mm-hmm. While there's been some sort of asteroid strike or something, it's like a post-apocalyptic almost setting with the horse and the boy. And it's very odd, really. So that's why I asked.
You sort of wonder if he was running out of ideas for ordinary horse stories, you know, that, okay, well, let's have a post-Holocaust horse story and see what that seems like.
It might have been something like that, or he was just feeling really depressed. I don't know. He kind of reads that way too. So you mentioned the historical, and when you did start becoming published, I know that your first books were historical novels, were they not?
My first published books were, yes.
First published books?
Yeah.
There were some unpublished ones that weren't?
Yes. Yeah. There were a whole host of projects that I never completed for one reason or another, including science fiction and fantasy. I wrote a sort of literary novel that took place in the Civil War that attracted some attention but never got published. And I followed that up with a murder mystery, and then had the idea for a series of sea adventure novels. And those were the ones that sold. They're in the realm of C.S. Forrester or Jack Aubrey, you know, that except that my heroes were Americans rather than Royal Navy.
Did you have any? And I've always had a fondness for sea stories. One of the series I read growing up was a series of British children's books called Swallows and Amazons, in which the kids sail. Now they're just sailing like little sailing dinghies around the Lake District and England for many of the books. But in their mind, they're having these sea adventures with pirates and broadsides and all that stuff going on. And I think that's where my interest in sea stories came. Did you have any connection to the sea other than just wanting to write about it?
Well, I think growing up on Lake Superior had a lot to do with it. Lake Superior is, you know, it's the largest body of fresh water on the planet. And it is, it's pretty much a sea of its own. And also growing up in Minnesota, the land of 10,000 lakes, I spent a lot of time in the water when I was a kid, and on boats. So, and I grew up and I became a small boat sailor and a scuba diver. So, it's been a consistent thing in my life.
And that series you've brought out as ebooks now, haven't you, after they were not available for a while? It's called Privateers and Gentlemen.
Right, that's the series title. And I also restored my original titles. The original publisher was Dell, and they had a formula for how they wanted series books to be titled, which was the adjective, and the adjective could change. But it had to be a two-word title. The first word had to be the.
That gets repetitious after a while, I would think.
Yeah. And especially as I had much better titles, and those titles are now restored to the books that needed them.
Where could people get those if they wanted to read them?
At your favorite online bookstore.
Available everywhere?
Available everywhere I can find to put it, yeah.
So how did you make the switch from the historicals to science fiction?
That was easy. The historicals, the market for historical fiction in the United States completely collapsed about May of 1982. And so what I planned as a 10-book series became a 5-book series. And so I spent a desperate 6 months writing proposals for things that didn't sell. And it was across the spectrum. I wrote proposals for mysteries, for historicals, for science, not for science fiction, actually. And everything but category romance, I think. And none of them sold. And then a science fiction proposal that I'd written some years before sold. And so I became a science fiction writer. And the science fiction proposal had been bouncing around publisher to publisher without being read. It's kind of a fascinating saga, but it's probably too long for this interview. It sort of explains how publishers can screw up repeatedly. And then it finally ended up at Tor Books, and the editor at that point was Jim Bain. And there were only three people in the office. There was Tom Doherty, who was the publisher, Jim Bain, the editor, and then there was Mrs. Doherty, who was the accounting department. Now Tor is the largest science fiction publisher, and it doesn't run like that anymore. But Jim Bain read the proposal and bought it, and although it had been on the market for 2 or 3 years, it actually sold to the first editor who read it.
How did it not get read at the other places that it had been?
Well, there was a lot of mergers going on in publishing, as there is now. I don't recall the exact sequence, but, it was sent to Ace. And Susan Allison, who was the editor at Ace, left Ace to go to Berkeley. And until she was replaced, they put a buying hold. So then it came back, and then it was sent to Berkeley, and to Susan Allison at Berkeley. And then Berkeley acquired Ace. And suddenly they had too many manuscripts sitting in the office. So another buying hold went. And then it went to David Hartwell at Timescape, and it was lost in the mailroom for about 6 months. And by the time that was discovered, they had put a buying hold on. And so it just kept bouncing off of these things until it actually went to an editor who still had a publishing schedule to fill up.
That must have been satisfying when it when it finally sold.
I was greatly relieved because I was, beginning to look in the help wanted section of the paper. So that I could make my rent. And suddenly, although it has to be said that the science fiction sold for a lot less money than the historical fiction did. So I was, it took me a few years before I could reach my former miserable standard of living from where I was merely poor instead of in wretched poverty.
Yeah, I can relate. There was also a venture into writing for games, and I mean, you've written for, I know, and you know, I've been a full-time freelancer for 30 years, and I know you do, you know, anything for a buck, basically. But how did you get involved on the gaming side, and have you kept your hand in there?
I'd always been doing games. I've been playing games for a long time. Avalon Hill games and SPI games, the historical war games and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And
I played
then
two of those.
Eventually Dungeons and Dragons. And so I was familiar with the genre. And what happened was Jim Bain formed his own publishing company. He left Tor, formed Bain Books, and he also decided to get into computer games, which was a new thing. And because he had a distribution deal with Simon & Schuster, he was going to market his computer games through Simon & Schuster, and they would appear on every bookstore in America and be a huge success. Except he didn't realize that the crack Simon & Schuster sales force weren't interested in computer games, didn't know how to sell them, and didn't care to try. And so it ended up being a terrible failure. And I did write four computer games for Bain Software, of which only one saw print. And the company collapsed before the others could appear.
I'm curious about it because it's, you know, I've never done it, and I've always thought it might be interesting to do. It's playing them, it seems to me like there's an there is a lot of dialogue that has to be written for every conceivable iteration of how the game might play. Is that a fair description of it?
Well, especially with, say, a large scale computer game. I did write the dialogue for a game called Spore, which was a sort of galactic adventure with many different alien races that fit various categories of being warlike or mercenary or capitalistic or concerned about ecosystems or whatever. And so, when you say hello to one of them, depending on what kind of alien they are, which category they fit into, they will respond in character, and you end up having these long dialogues with these people. And it was done very imaginatively. They found voice artists who could do gibberish. And so, you know, you would say hello, and this gibberish would come back at you along with the translation. And that was quite epic, but fortunately I was paid quite well for it. It's incredibly tedious, mind-numbing work, and I was the second writer that they hired. The first one had, I think, OD'd on it and gone kind of nuts. And so they wanted someone who could rein it in a little more.
You didn't have to write the gibberish. That was just the voice actors made that up.
Yeah,
that
was the voice actors, yeah.
You also done some screenwriting, haven't you?
I have. I wrote several movies that never got made, which is a typical screenwriter experience, I should point out. 99% of scripts never get made. But I got paid for writing, and the only thing you can see of mine is a science fiction show called Andromeda, and I had one episode in the first season. There were just epic casting problems on that particular episode. And so it was rewritten, I think, 27 times in the 10 days that it took to shoot, when they realized that their guest star couldn't act and couldn't remember lines.
The fellow I interviewed for the last episode of this podcast, Chris Humphreys, is both a writer and an actor, and he actually played a Starfleet commander on Andromeda at some point, but hopefully not in that episode.
No, there weren't any Starfleet commanders in that episode.
All right, well, let's talk about your novels then. Well, okay, that does kind of tie in, because I'm curious, whenever I talk to somebody who's done screenwriting or other forms of writing like that, do you learn something doing that you then bring to your novels, or Or was it the other way around? Yeah, was the fact that you're a novelist?
Yeah. By the time I was an established writer by the time I did any of these screenplays, so I already knew how to write fiction. But the main thing was a kind of mental switch, because in my fiction, my characters all have strong inner lives, and they're always thinking and reacting and having emotional responses to what's going on, but it's not necessarily visible to any of the other characters. But you can't have that in a screenplay. You can't have somebody think in a screenplay and not tell you what he's thinking. All the audience sees is action and dialogue. And so I had to make that adjustment. My characters couldn't have inner lives. It was only outer lives.
Well, do some stage acting, and I've written plays, and it's much the same thing. Everything is driven by the visible action and the dialogue, and whatever the actor can do to emote. But yeah, you know, you everybody interprets that differently depending on who the person is that's viewing it.
Yeah, I did have, you know, second readers on my screenplays and stuff, and they would ask, "I don't understand why your character is doing this," and I said, "Well, because he worked it out in his head that this is what he should do," and then that's not a viable approach for screenwriting.
There's the few where they have a voiceover narration, but that always seems a little forced after a while.
I really miss the art of soliloquy. I wish I could was living in Shakespearean times, so that I could just have the character turn to the audience and explain what he was going to do.
If you ever get a chance, there's a show on Amazon Prime now. It's from the BBC called Upstart Crow, which is a situation comedy about Shakespeare writing his plays.
It is terrific. I've seen all three seasons.
Yeah, the guy thought of that because of the actors will turn to the front and say, "By strict convention, I can now say what I want to say, and nobody around me can hear what I'm."
Yes.
Well, let's talk about your writing of novels then. Now, Fleet Elements, that's the most recent one. Well, right. You have a new short story collection we'll mention as well later on. Mm-hmm. So using that as an example, we'll talk about how you write your novels. And I guess the first thing then would be a bit of a synopsis without giving away anything you don't want to give away.
Well, my elevator pitch is War and Revolution as seen through the eyes of a pair of star-crossed lovers. Or alternatively, star-crossed lovers experience war and revolution. But it is set in the far future in a somewhat decrepit space empire in which humanity and several other alien species have become, were conquered by another race. And that other race is gone now. They all died. And now we, the human race, and these other species have to figure out what comes next, because they're very good at taking instruction from these totalitarian aliens, but the totalitarian aliens aren't giving them instructions anymore. And now they have to work it out on their own, and they're not used to that, and they're not very good at it. And I should point out, this was inspired by I was reading a lot of classical history, Polybius and Livian, people like that. And they were they told this wide scale history with very vivid characters, and I thought I should be able to do that. And so, when I planned this series 20 years ago now, I planned it for 9 to 12 volumes, various reasons. The fifth or seventh one has just come out, depending on how you count them. This is the fifth one from HarperCollins, but there was one from Tor that was a novella, and there was another novella that I published on my own. So I think of this Fleet Elements as book 7, but the publisher thinks of it as book 5.
Do you know exactly how many volumes it's going to be now, or is it still in flux?
I think 12.
So not even halfway yet, well, depending on how you count.
Yeah, I've plotted them all out. I know it's going to happen in all of them. That's part of my process, is with the first trilogy, I knew what the last line of the last book was going to be before I wrote the first line of the first book. I always have the end in view, and I always know where I'm going. Sometimes there's a certain amount of difficulty in getting there. I always know the beginning of the book really well, and I know the end of the book really well, and with the middle part is sometimes a bit of a mystery, and that's where I tend to struggle.
Well, you mentioned what the inspiration was. Is that typical of the way ideas? I mean, ideas come from everywhere, I know, and it's a cliche to ask, where do you get your ideas? But was that fairly typical for you, something you've read or just something you're thinking about? Or how does it work for you?
Very often I get an idea just from reading other people's fiction. And I see something that was undeveloped or something that could be viewed in some other way. And usually, you know, even my short fiction, there's more than one idea happening. So I tend to like the collision of ideas. So I'll wait till I get a certain number of ideas that are kind of undeveloped, and then I will sort of have them smash each other head on like particles in a particle beam accelerator, just to see what happens.
See what kind of strange quirks emerge.
Yeah.
Then you mentioned a little bit about knowing the beginning and the end, but are you much of an outliner? I mean, this is a big sprawling series.
Yeah.
How much work did you do ahead of time to plan it out? What does that look like for you? Is it very detailed or more sketchy or what?
When I'm working on one project, I'm always thinking about other projects. So I was able to plot out 12 volumes while I was writing something else. Because that's just usually how it works. You know, I'm not a very fast writer. I'm a plotter, but I'm persistent. I don't, you know, I write every day. I just don't write a huge amount of words every day. So, you know, I have a lot of time to think about my next projects, and I have probably outlined, at least in my head, more projects than I can write in a lifetime.
What does the actual outline that's not in your head look like?
Well, there are a couple kinds of outline. I mean, I have to write a synopsis for the publisher.
Right.
Because publishers require synopsis and sample chapters. Even for writers that they know well now. I mean, I recently, you know, sent a proposal to an editor I knew well, right? And he said, look, the company requires me to have sample chapters. I know you can write. I know you don't need to write these sample chapters. You don't have to prove anything to me. But the company has this checklist, and I have to put that check there.
Oh.
And so I wrote him his damn sample chapters. You know, it was really annoying.
I don't have to do that with DAW. I'm still just getting by with the synopsis.
Well, that's because DAW is still family-owned.
Yeah, I think that's the difference.
They aren't owned by an international corporation. Good for them.
So your synopsis will be like 10 single-spaced pages, or what does that look like for you?
Well, 10 double-spaced pages. I mean, but I write outlines for myself, and they are a lot more eccentric. I tend to write them on yellow legal pads in colored ink with different characters being represented by a different colored ink and arrows and timelines and stuff like that. It would be incomprehensible to anyone else. I know what all this stuff means, all these weird scribbles, but I can't see anyone else getting a hold of one of those outlines and being able to write a book from it.
How closely do you follow your outlines once you actually start the writing process? Do you find that you wander off as you create things along the way, or are you fairly
strict? Well, the outlines are just outlines, and I don't so much wander away from the outlines as I find other aspects of the story that would contribute to the value of the fiction, right? So, I find new sidelights on characters, new sidelights on the action. And so for me, it's a process of addition. I start with the outline and then I add things as I go if I think they would contribute.
And what about your characters? Do you do a lot of detailed work on them beforehand, or do you discover them as you write?
I pretty much, the major characters, I know pretty well by the time I start. I don't always write down their personalities or all the little details and stuff. I have that, but I have it worked out in my head.
You mentioned that you write every day. What does your actual writing process look like? You outline on yellow legal paper, but I bet you don't write on yellow legal paper longhand.
No, I write on a computer. I use Scrivener, which is a software that is developed specifically for writing fiction.
Yeah, I have it, and I've never climbed the learning curve to use it. I'm still plugging away on Word.
Well, the thing is that as with every modern word processing program, most of it is stuff you'll never use.
Certainly true of Word.
Yeah, and it's true of Scrivener too. There's just a lot of stuff in there that you probably won't ever use, but it does have a very useful outlining function where it actually gives you the index cards and the little pins, and you can put them in and rearrange them and stuff, and allows you to rearrange scenes very easily, which is extremely useful in at least some of my projects, where I'm not too sure on the chronology until it's all done.
Yeah, I should probably, the one I'm working on now, space opera called The Tangled Stars, and it's kind of tangled my brain too, so I should probably be using Scrivener. It might help. So you said you're not a fast writer. What, do you have a set word count you try to get done every day? Or
I seem to average about 500 words a day. It's not a lot, but I get to write one book a year plus some short fiction. And that's what it amounts to.
And once you have your first draft, how does the revision process start for you? Do you write in drafts? Do you do rolling revision or what?
I don't anymore because word processors make it so easy to revise. So probably by the time I'm done with my, quote, first draft, unquote, everything's been gone over half a dozen times. Hmm. I always start my day by revising the previous day's work. And whenever I have to go back and look something up, I'll probably revise it a bit. So it's ideally, it's very polished by the time I get to the end of the first draft. So revision for the second draft is generally pretty quick and easy, just because I've been over it so many times.
That's interesting, because the very first person I interviewed on here was John Scalzi, and he was talking about how he does rolling revisions. Mm-hmm. But then I've talked to other people who started on typewriter, as I'm sure you did, because I did, and you're maybe a little bit older than me, I'm not sure, but somewhere along in there. And he thought that people who wrote on typewriters tended to still do single drafts and then go back to the beginning and revise it as you had to do on a typewritten manuscript,
right,
pretty much. But it sounds like you've switched more to the word processing.
I'm very pleased that I never have to use a carbon ever again.
Yeah.
Since I've adopted a word processor as opposed to a typewriter, my books have gotten a lot more complex simply because the word processor makes that easy to do. The stuff I wrote on typewriters was very straightforward.
I still remember the first decent printer I had, because of course dot matrix printers, editors didn't want that. I had a daisy wheel printer, but I had to feed the paper into it just like it was a typewriter. I wasn't typing it, but I still had to sit there and it would make a carbon. So I was still using carbon paper and feeding it into my daisy wheel printer. I don't miss that.
Yeah.
I'm old. So do you use beta readers or anything like that? A lot of people do when they
I use my wife, who is a very good beta reader and who is, who has worked as a copy editor in the past. So
that
I get a free copy edit. Which is pretty cool. And but I used to belong to several workshops, and I would workshop everything. And then I started a workshop of my own called Tao's Toolbox, where I actually teach writing for 2 weeks up in a ski lodge in northern New Mexico every summer.
Oh, nice.
And I work with Nancy Kress, who is just brilliant at teaching.
That's where I heard that, because I interviewed Nancy, and I think she mentioned it.
But it kind of ruined me for workshopping, because during that 2 weeks, I have to read and critique maybe 350,000 words of fiction. Hmm. And I am so burnt out by that process that it takes me a year to recover. And I just don't want to workshop anymore. I don't want to have to read anybody else's drafts until it's time to do Tao's toolbox again.
I've done a smidgen of teaching, and I've been a writer in residence and worked with a lot of writers in a couple of libraries. I've been writer in residence. Do you find that teaching writing benefits you as a writer?
Not that much. I do occasionally, you know, get excited about one of the students, and you know, and but I'm mainly teaching in this. I'm not necessarily out to learn new tricks. I encountered a dilemma in my current project, and I went back and looked at my own lecture notes, which I normally don't do. I look at my lecture notes, and I found the solution to the problem I was having. That was kind of fun. I actually took my own advice.
I was actually going to ask, because that's something I found. You know, I will confidently tell somebody, you know, you should do like this or something like this. And then I think, just don't look in that book I wrote where I didn't do that.
Yeah.
Because it's easy to give advice sometimes that you don't take yourself. That's certainly a common...
Writers are very individual, and they each need, you know, critique and so on that is pitched to them. And this is why Nancy and I do so well, because Nancy has a completely different approach to writing than I do. I'm a plotter. She's a pantser. And so if my approach won't work for you, her approach will.
Well, that's one of the reasons for this podcast is why it's, you know, it's focused on this kind of stuff, so that people can go and find out that there is no one right way to do this thing. Because you'll hear every possible approach from somebody that I've interviewed or will interview in the future, I'm sure. So going back to the revision, are there specific things you find that you have to work on in revision? Like, is there a consistent tick that you have to clean up or anything like that?
Well, my first drafts tend to have very elaborate, long sentences with peculiar syntax and a lot of words derived from Latin roots, polysyllabic words from Latin roots. And so I have to remind myself to make the syntax a lot more straightforward, replace the Latin words with Anglo-Saxon words, which are punchier. That's my typical... I mean, if you actually saw a very first draft of mine, you would think I was hopeless. I really do need to spend a lot of time polishing it to make it readable.
But clearly you get there.
Yeah. I think a lot of it is English is not my first language. And so it's a struggle to translate the language that's going on in my head into English.
What is your first language?
I don't know. It's
perhaps it's Latin.
It seems to be a symbolic language. It's like when I think, it's like laying out an array of tarot cards. And so I have these different symbols that together all mean something. But when I translate it, I have to literally do the translation and add the grammar and all of that. I'm the only person I know who has this problem. Most people apparently think in their native language, and I guess I do too, except it's not English.
That rings a bell from somebody who was talking about they were startled to realize that other people didn't think the way they thought. And I don't remember if it was exactly along those lines, but somebody else had told me something similar to that, which I find it fascinating, because, you know, one of the things about writing is we present the illusion that we know how other people think.
Right.
But really, we don't. We don't have a clue what goes on inside anybody else's head.
Well, I know what's going on in my characters' heads, and that's kind of all that matters as far as my books go.
So yeah.
I know how they think.
But your readers come to that and will actually take something different than what you're picturing in your head when you're writing.
Yeah.
Because it is a collaborative art form.
I find that people read the book that they want to read, and it isn't necessarily the one that I wrote.
So once you have the book and it goes off to the publisher, what does the editorial process typically look like for you? Are there things that come back, or is it pretty clean?
Sitting around for months waiting for my notes. And, I won't name any names, but I turned in a book last September, and I'm just getting the notes from it today, supposedly.
Well, it'll be, you'll be looking at it with a fresh eye,
I guess. Yeah. So I'm going to be doing, spend the next week doing a bunch of rewriting, I expect. Unless he says, oh, it's okay, we'll just send it to the copy editor.
Are there things that you typically get editorial notes about? Like, in my case, from Sheila Gilbert at Daw, it's usually, I didn't explain enough about some aspect of this, or, the characters need a little more development, or that sort of thing.
Yeah. Generally, I think because I know too much about the way that my characters think, I don't necessarily explain their motives and actions as clearly as I could. Hmm. So it's always useful to have someone say, I need to understand why this action is happening now. And then I can handle that. Another thing I tend to do is I can overdo things. It's just the prose just becomes too much. And I need somebody to tell me when to back down, back off, and let the story happen instead of scenes of hallucinogenic intensity.
That sounds like you really enjoy the words themselves. Is that
I do.
Fair to say?
I do. I have a series out now called Quillifer, which is basically my love letter to the English language. I mean, aside from being a jolly good read, but I am deliberately spending a lot of time playing with the language in that series.
I do love a good convoluted sentence myself, as people will have told me, so I can appreciate that. I also wanted to, you have written a lot of short stories, and in fact, you have a collection out now. You said not novellas mostly, but some short stories.
Just out this week. And it's The Best of Walter John Williams, oddly enough, out from Subterranean Press. It's 200,000 words of fiction, which is, a couple novels worth. Mostly it's longer short fiction, novelettes and novellas, including a lot of award nominees and a few award winners. I'm very proud of it. I just wish I could have added another 100,000 words.
Well, that's volume two.
Some stories that I wish, there was room for.
Of course, if you call the first one The Best of Walter John Williams, would you have to call the second one the second best of Walter John Williams?
I think even more best.
Even more best.
Even more bester. Even more bester of Walter John Williams.
So these would go back for right through your entire career? Or?
Pretty much, yeah. It's from the mid 80s through the fairly recent present. And it's sort of every stage of my career represented.
So you write novels and short stories. Do you think you have a preference or one that you're better at than the others? I always think some people are better at short stories and some people are better at novels. Are you good at both?
I think my best work is in the shorter form. Because in something that is of a modest length, everything can be perfect. You can actually put everything in it that you think ought to be there and make sure it's available to the reader. For a novel, something the length of a novel, something's going to go wrong somewhere. There's going to be a mistake. There's going to be, some of my tangled syntax got through all the editing. I view my novels as good but necessarily flawed, which is how I view everybody's novels. But yeah. My short fiction, I'm very proud of.
I've often used the metaphor of where you have this in your head, the story is this beautiful, shiny Christmas ornament, absolutely perfect. And then you smash it with a hammer and try to glue it back together with words. That's the way it feels to me. That initial moment of, oh, this is going to be perfect. And then you can't actually get the perfect, unfortunately.
Yeah.
Well, I'm going to ask the big philosophical questions here.
Uh-oh.
I'm going to put reverb on that someday.
Right.
You've been writing for a long time. You say you always wanted to be a writer, but the first one is, why? Why do you write?
It remains a mystery. It was a compulsion. It was an irresistible compulsion to be a writer. And that irresistible compulsion lasted from when I was, say, 4 years old to when I was around 40. It began to fade. And so then I realized I was no longer compelled to do this, but it was kind of the only thing I was good at. You know, it's not like I have a work history. My last real job was like in 1978. And so I have no job. I'm not even qualified to be a greeter at Walmart in terms of the straight world. So, but what I realized I had to do was I had to find some reason to love what I was doing and to really love the craft and love everything I was working on and find joy and delight in it. That wasn't necessary before. I didn't have to love it. All I had to do was just write it because I was compelled to do that. So I think my approach to writing now comes from love. And this is what I tell my students. If you don't love it, don't do it.
Don't do it for the money.
Yeah. Yeah. Cause there won't be any odds are.
So why you say you've found a love for it. Why do you love it now? Or what do you love about it?
Why do you ask these complicated questions? I enjoy doing stuff that I'm good at. And this is the thing that I'm best at, is writing fiction. And I do a lot of other stuff. You know, I'm a scuba diver. I'm a martial artist. And I love all that to a certain degree. But that's not where... my home world is. My home world is fiction.
Do you find some love in the love that your readers give back to you when they read something of yours and they really enjoy it?
It's always gratifying when I hear from the readers. But see, the thing is that between the time that I finish a project and the time that it appears in print, I've written a bunch more on other projects. Mm-hmm. So, you know, when a novel comes out, I may have written two novels in the period of time between finishing that one and it appearing in print. So my head is in another place. And once I deliver a book, it's kind of not mine anymore. It kind of belongs to the reader. There's a time in which I know I'm the only person that possesses this work, right? When I'm working at it, and then I can really love it, and I can feel like I possess it and own it. And then I give it away, hopefully for money, but I give it away, and then it belongs to other people
who may be discovering it 20 years from now. For all you know, once they're out there, they're out there. Okay, so that's why you write. Why do you think, in the bigger picture, why do any of us write? Why do human beings do this strange thing?
Well, I think storytelling is a compunction. I think we make stories out of anything. I mean, I just, you know, look at a newscast, right? They don't just tell you this happened. They make a story about it so that you'll be involved in it and that you'll care. Because we're in a COVID pandemic right now, and one of the things that television can shoot safely is reality TV, right? Because they can get everyone in one place and isolate. And so I've watched a lot of that, and one thing that I've noticed is that if you're completing a project on some reality television show, you have to tell a story about it. It's not just, oh, I made this cool thing. This story connects to the deepest wellsprings of my childhood. And it's all about my grandmother who passed away just 2 months ago. And I'm still, you know, and the audience responds to that. It may not even be true. In fact, it probably isn't. They probably learned that they have to tell that soap opera is where you're going with these kind of shows. I don't know why anyone else writes. I'll just say, I'm glad that they do. Some people, it's a bucket list. You know, they actually write a novel. on their bucket list, and then they write it and either sell it or self-publish it, and then they go on to the next item on their bucket list. I don't understand that at all. It's just, it's too much work to write a novel just to tick off a something on a list.
Yeah, just put beat your head against the wall. It'd be simpler.
Yeah. And some just write for mercenary motives, which I don't get either. Because I, so far as I can tell, these people aren't rich.
Yeah. And the third question is, why write stories of the fantastic, specifically science fiction and fantasy? Where does, why do we write about things that aren't real?
Well, in my case, it seems to be what I'm good at. I just seem to come at reality from a somewhat sideways perspective. And I have written other stuff, and I have a whole lot of unsold fiction sitting around that's in other various categories, literary fiction or mysteries or whatever. But what I kept being told is, this is too strange. We can't publish this. I hardly ever say that with science fiction. And when I write science fiction, I can write about anything, so long as it has certain science fiction elements. So War and Revolution from the point of view of star-crossed lovers. I wrote the world's only Gothic Western police procedural science fiction novel called Days of Atonement. Set in Silver City, by the way.
Oh, really?
a fictional analog of Silver City, but you know, if you know New Mexico, you know where you are. I've written cyberpunk. I've written anthropological science fiction. I've written, I don't know how to describe it, gonzo science fiction, I guess. Really high concept stuff. I've written near future science fiction that actually got overtaken by events. I wrote a novel about the Arab Spring, and it appeared the week that the Arab Spring started. So that's one of my more successful predictions, I'd like to think. And oddly enough, no one cared. My agent was out there contacting, you know, every news organization in the world saying, my writer predicted that this was going to happen, and the book is out, and you should talk to him. And they said, no, I'm sorry, we have our own analysts. We pay them.
So what are you,
Deep State, sorry, for any of you who are interested.
What was it? What was the name of it?
Deep State. It was the middle book of a series about alternate reality gaming, oddly. And I they are also now all available from me as ebooks. But it begins with "This is not a game" as the first one. And there are, I should say, I made a mistake. I said there are four, although the last one is a novella. It was interesting going back, because I mounted my own editions, and I went back and I was reading the reviews, and one of them said, these are really good books, but this is in no way science fiction. And I said, they were science fiction when I wrote them. And then it all happened. So once again, it's kind of a matter of timing. I wrote a Black Lives Matter novel 25 years ago called The Rift. And it was such a colossal commercial failure that I didn't sell another book for 5 years. So timing is everything. If I wrote a Black Lives Matter novel now, it might do better.
Or there'd be so many of them that it would get lost in the...
Yeah, that's true.
So what are you working on now? You've touched on it a little bit.
I'm working on the next book in the Praxis series. So Fleet Elements, to be followed by The Restoration. And I'm about halfway through that book.
When is it expected out?
Probably late 2022. Because I'm scheduled to deliver it later this year. And it'll spend at least a year in production.
And anything else?
Yes, I have my Quillifer series, which is high fantasy, and my love letter to the English language. The third book of that will appear around the new year. I don't know, the final schedule hasn't been decided yet. But the It makes me happy to write these books. It's mm-hmm. just like a delight to write Quilliver, because he's just so much fun, and they are sort of a swashbuckler. Sort of, it's Raphael Sabatini meets Michael Moorcock meets Tolkien, I guess. He's a kind of impish character, and I like writing impish characters.
So lots for people to look forward to, it sounds like, in the not too distant future.
Yes.
And of course, the short story.
Well, they can prepare for it by reading the two earlier books in the series, which are already out, Quilliver and Quilliver the Night.
That sounds like my cup of tea, so I'm going to have to check those out.
Well, please do.
And where can people find you online?
www.walterjohnwilliams.net. I'm the only person I know who has a .net instead of a .com, but somebody had already stolen my identity with the .com.
And just for those who don't know, you should know, but it's John without an H.
Yes. Yes.
All right. Well, thanks so much for being on. I enjoyed that. I hope you did too.
It was great fun. Thank you.
And say hi to Nancy the next time you see her, because she was a guest on here not too long ago.
Okay. All right.
All right.
Good talking to you.
Bye for now.
Bye-bye.
So thanks again to Walter John Williams for that great conversation. I certainly enjoyed it, and I hope that you did too. Just a reminder that you can find The World Shapers online at theworldshapers.com, where you'll find a complete archive of all past episodes. Most of them have full transcripts, as indeed this one does. You can also find The World Shapers on Twitter at The World Shapers. You can find it on Facebook at The World Shapers Podcast. You can find me online at edwardwillett.com, two T's on Willett. You can find my books, autographed books, can be purchased through edwardwillettshop.com. My publishing company is shadowpawpress.com. That's what will be publishing the Shapers of Worlds anthology, currently kickstarting, which I will mention again in a moment. You can find me on Twitter at ewillett, E-W-I-L-L-E-T-T. You can find me on Instagram at edwardwillettauthor. You can find me on YouTube. I have a channel where I'm currently doing live walks around my hometown of Regina, Saskatchewan. I hope to continue doing that, so tune in there if you're interested in that sort of thing. And, you can also find Shadowpaw Press online at, on the Twitter, I mean, at Shadowpaw Press. So, did just want to mention again, before I say goodbye completely, the Kickstarter now running. I'm looking for $15,000 Canadian. It's about 43% funded. It just started on Tuesday of this last week, on March 9th, and it runs through April 8th. Amazing collection of authors who will be contributing original stories and reprints, more original stories than reprints this time, 18 original stories, if this all funds, short fiction, science fiction, and fantasy. And lots of great backers rewards from those authors as well, including tons of signed books, audiobooks, ebooks, all kinds of stuff. So go to tinyurl.com/shapersofworlds2, with not Roman numeral 2, but the Arabic numeral 2 at the end of that, Shapers of Worlds 2. And you can find all the details about that. And I hope that you will consider kicking in and being part of this exciting project. That's it for this episode of The World Shapers. I'll be back soon with another episode as I continue to talk to the science fiction and fantasy authors who have created the memorable worlds and characters where we have enjoyed adventures and in whose company we have enjoyed adventures for so many years. Walter John Williams talked about his sentences getting convoluted, and that's exactly what just happened there. I'm doing this without a script, so that's my ad lib. My ad libs can become quite convoluted. Anyway, that's it for this episode of Kickstarted book is Shapers of Worlds. This is the podcast, which is called The World Shapers. And that concludes this episode. Thanks for listening.